listening to One to One with Paul Costello, a podcast from the Stanford School of Medicine.
From the White House to presidential candidates on the campaign trail, new attention is being paid to a growing nationwide public health crisis, an epidemic of heroin use. In the last 13 years, there have been a fourfold increase in heroin overdoses in the United States. Keith Humphrey is an addiction specialist and professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the Stanford School of Medicine, says his latest growth in heroin use is propelled by the large number of prescriptions for opioid painkillers. USA Today recently reported that in 2012, physicians wrote 259 million prescriptions for painkillers, enough to give a bottle of pills to every adult in the United States. And according to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, more than 2 million Americans abuse prescription opiates, and many turn to heroin, a cheaper alternative, when they can no longer afford painkillers. Today we'll talk with Keith Humphreys about the heroin epidemic that is hitting New England, East Coast cities, and Appalachia, and whether enough is being done to respond and combat it. Keith, thank you for joining me in One to One. You know, this, I don't know if this is accurate, but has this heroin epidemic crept out of nowhere? It's now brought the attention of the White House with $2.5 million, which doesn't sound like much money at all, and in anti-drug programs in New England, Appalachia, and some East Coast cities. So how did this arise?
The heroin epidemic that seems to be starting now really comes out of an older epidemic, which is the prescription opioid epidemic, which is still ongoing. And that starts in the late 1990s. A number of doctors get concerned, justifiably concerned, that pain is undertreated, which is true. And that message was sort of taken over by some pharmaceutical companies, especially Purdue Pharma, into a different message, which was, everyone should be prescribing opiates, and there's no risk to prescribe, so just go ahead and go for it. And through very aggressive marketing, they managed to increase American prescribing by about 400%.
I've been surprised that I had dental surgery not long ago. I've had some other things. And each time I've been offered and given prescriptions for opioids, and no one has ever asked me if I have addiction problems,
right,
if any of my background, any history, any knowledge about, am I an abuser?
Well, one of the ways these were marketed was to tell docs there is no risk. You can go as high as you want. And that's partly why Purdue Pharma, of course, was found criminally liable and had to pay, I think, something like $500 million fine, because they told a lot of docs who were not generally used to dealing with either addiction or pain, you know, that this, if a person had asked for more, just give them more. It's not risky. And so they did. And I hear stories all the time, to me, most disturbing, with people's kids. You know, their 14-year-old gets a tooth pulled, and the dentist writes them, you know, a script for 30 Vicodin, which is crazy. When that becomes normative, you just build up a massive pool of opioids everywhere. American docs wrote about 250 million prescriptions for opioids last year.
Yeah, I have a figure from 2012, 259 million prescriptions,
right,
for painkillers.
Right.
Enough to give a bottle of pills to every adult in the United States.
Yeah, absolutely astonishing. And some of that massive increase probably did some good. There's some people probably in pain who are not in pain, and that's really good. But the rate of overdose and the rate of addiction has gone up side by side with that prescription opioid increase. You know, as one doubles, the other doubles.
So trace the connection, opioids to heroin.
Right. So then you have a pool of people, millions of people, who are now addicted to OxyContin, Vicodin, and so on. And two things happen. One is that, you know, generally you build up tolerance when you start taking a drug over and over. So they may be in a situation where they start needing 2 Vicodin a day, and then they need 6, and they need 12, and then they need 20, and it gets more and more expensive. So where do you get, a cheaper opioid? Well, you go to the heroin market, which is substantially cheaper. The other thing that happened is there were some controls put in. So there is now some abuse-resistant formulation of OxyContin, doctors are getting a little more careful. There's some prescription monitoring. It's not great. I mean, it's not extensive is what I mean. We still write a huge number of prescriptions, but it's getting a little harder to get these when you don't need them. And so some people then are sort of stuck. They're like, gosh, I'm addicted to opioids. My doc has said, you know, I caught you. You have prescriptions from five doctors. I'm not going to write for you anymore. Where do they go? Well, they often go into the black market for heroin.
They go to the street for heroin.
That's right,
basically.
Yeah.
You know, why is it these pockets of, you know, when I heard that New Hampshire, the governor of New Hampshire, talking about the significant problem there and ripples through New England, and then you have East Coast cities and you have Appalachia. And I'm wondering, what's the tie-in here between the socioeconomic crisis in many of these places that you know, the industries have changed, the jobs have changed, you have significant unemployment. What's the tie-in and connection there?
Yeah, it's been true generally through American history that drug epidemics are heavily regionalized. So the heroin epidemic that hit this country in the late 60s and early 70s was concentrated in large cities, most of them on the East Coast. Part of that has to do with drug markets and where supply comes from and where established dealers are. And then other parts have to do with local culture. You know, this is a heroin town. It's not a heroin town. You know, meth has been coded culturally as something that rural people use. And I've had urban, heavily drug addicted people be offended at me when I ask them if they use methamphetamine. You know, it's like, I'm not a hick. You know, I'm from New York. We don't use meth. So you see that. The other thing is, you know, the stuff you're alluding to is really important, is that, you know, when people are in situations where there are fewer alternative rewards and less structure to life. So, for example, West Virginia, where I grew up, which has a terrible problem, you have a lot of people who are unemployed or marginally employed, poor, there's not a lot of opportunities to have fun, and there is cheap opioids everywhere. It's very tempting to use them, and it's easier to get hooked on them because you got less to lose and less good things to compete with the short-term pleasures of those drugs.
So are there still twin epidemics in many respects? We still have significant methamphetamine use, and we still have significant heroin use? Or is heroin sort of, have meth users gone to heroin? Is there any change there?
Well, there's always been some people who like to mix stimulants and opioids. Mm-hmm. You know, speedballing was, you know, sort of a rage in the 80s, which is cocaine and heroin together. But the markets have some distinctions. I mean, this new heroin market is sort of urban and suburban. The meth market is more rural. So, you know, you see it in, you know, Kentucky, for example, has quite a bit of meth. There are places, though, where you see both, like Indiana, you know, has had a combination of injection opioid use and then also have had an enduring meth problem.
So talk about the heroin user. Who are they? What's the makeup of this person?
Yeah. So one thing everyone should know about something quite sad about our governance at this moment is, you know, the Congress has come to a view that we don't want to spend as much money as we used to, and we don't want to cut entitlements, and we don't want to cut defense. And all that's left is what's called the discretionary budget. And what's unfortunate about that is what's in the discretionary budget is the National Institute of Health and most of the data gathering capacity of the federal government. So we know far less about this epidemic than we should. We would have known 10 years ago because some of the best data systems to talk about it have been cut and eliminated. So, I'll tell you what I know, but I'm saying this to say that is sad, and everything anyone says, including me, has to be taken with a grain of salt. So what we know is that of the people who are, you know, involved with heroin, they're overwhelmingly coming out of prescription opioid as their entry point. Studies say different things. 60, 70, 80% of people were addicted to opioids first, which they may have gotten, you know, because they had a back injury or something like that. They are much more white, apparently, than in the original heroin epidemic that happened in the 60s and 70s was about half Caucasians and then the rest people of color. This is a overwhelmingly white outbreak. And it's more suburban rather than being an inner city. There's also more people who are middle class involved in this than you typically see in drug epidemics.
And what are the ages? What are the demographics as far as age?
Yeah, it's poorly understood, but most people are probably young. I mean, almost all addictions tend to start when people are young, I should say, you know, when people are teenagers and young adults. But you do see a population of older folks who are sort of middle-aged who are using, you know, started on prescription opioids again and then are starting to use some heroin.
You know, I can, opioids don't have the kind of painkillers, et cetera. They have sort of mild sort of, you know, language around them. But heroin, heroin is a big word. Heroin is a scary word.
It scares people.
Heroin. So that's what really surprises me, I guess, is that there's this epidemic of a drug that has been known. It's not myth. It's known to be a devastator of lives, a destroyer of lives, a destroyer of fabrics of community. And that's why it's astonishing that people move from opioids to heroin.
Yeah, it's astonishing to the two of us because we are gentlemen of a certain age. But if you're 20, you don't know about the heroin epidemic of the 60s and 70s. You don't remember that. And there's been a number of epidemics of use of different substances, alcohol, cocaine, and all that, that seem to skip a generation. And one explanation for why that happens is, you know, if you're, you know, 10 years old and you see your family destroyed by crack, you develop fearful, negative attitudes about it, and then you don't do it. But then your kids, who don't remember that when it disappears, find it interesting again and sort of forget the horror. So there's probably a lot of generational forgetting. I mean, people don't remember that. That was a long time ago. The other thing is that the sociology of it is really fascinating. You know, crushed up OxyContin is incredibly dangerous. I mean, it's an extremely potent opiate, very similar to heroin. But because that comes from doctors, you know, and you know, we sort of think sociologically, well, you know, legal drug means safe, illegal drug means unsafe. And, you know, that's not true, but that's the way we think. And so people are terrified of the heroin epidemic, but really we should remember, you know, most of the deaths and most of the addiction right now is still coming from prescription opioids, not heroin.
You were in the Office of Drug Policy in the White House Office of Drug Policy in the first 2 years of the Obama administration. And can you talk about what does $2.5 million get you?
Not much. I mean, my view is, I think what they, you know, I applaud the, you know, the White House ONDCP for spending that money. But they don't have a lot of money. And this goes back to the general sort of federal constraint on spending right now. The Congress was a nice bipartisan bill, a Comprehensive Addiction Recovery Act that got, you know, some momentum, hasn't passed. That's like $80 million. The president has in his budget that Secretary Burwell of Health and Human Services defended to Congress, asked for like $130 million to respond to this. Those are all shockingly small to me. Overdoses in this country, all of them put together, the opioids, cocaine, alcohol, heroin, and so forth, are going to kill about 45,000 Americans this year. That's more people than died from AIDS at the peak of the AIDS epidemic. Could you imagine us responding to the AIDS epidemic with $50 million? We, quite appropriately, spent billions of dollars. And this is a massive crisis that is, and the bad luck is it's happening in an environment where the federal government is not able or willing to make the kind of resource commitment that's needed to respond to something on this scale.
What do you think is the root of that? Why do you think that is?
I don't think it's specific to heroin. I've been watching hearings and talking to people in the Congress, and people are generally scared about it. I think it's just a casualty of this broader struggle we have right now where things are frozen in Washington because of a fundamental disagreement about how much we want government, the federal government, to be involved in various types of problems. And that's caused, you know, many important things are not getting much attention because of that. And so then it falls to hard-hit states, some of whom do a lot, but of course states just can never bring the kind of resources to bear that the federal government can.
You wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post about the drug Naloxone?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And what is the drug and why is it important in this discussion?
So Naloxone is an old drug that a lot of people forgot, like they forgot the 70s heroin epidemic. But what it is it's called an antagonist. And when you take any opioid, you know, Vicodin, Lortab, heroin, whatever, it binds to a very specific part of your brain called the kappa receptor. And naloxone basically knocks that opioid right out of there. And so that means if someone's taking an opioid to the point of overdose and they've stopped breathing, which is why most people die, they almost immediately begin breathing again and it saves their life. It does not take away the addiction. But it gives them, you know, it lasts, you know, 30, 40 minutes or something like that, you know, 30-40 minutes, obviously, with little or no oxygen, that's life or death. And that gives a chance for the ambulance to get there or the person to get to the hospital. So this has been an emergency room since, I think, the late 60s. Most ambulances carried it. But what's been happening now, and I think is very productive, and I've worked on with some legislatures, is moving it out of those settings into the hands of more people, like cops, like firefighters, like people who work in homeless shelters, like moms and dads whose kids have a heroin problem, like people who themselves use drugs and may witness somebody else in overdose. And quite a few lives have been saved by that as that spread around the country.
And how does it interact with the drug abuse?
It doesn't in any way affect people's drug abuse. It doesn't take their drug abuse away.
It's just an immediate intervention.
That's right. That's right. It's not treatment. It's just life saving. So, you know, it's kind of like the paddles that are now in a lot of public places. Someone has a heart attack, you save their life. But of course, that doesn't treat their underlying heart problem. But, you know, with that, as those things get disseminated, I mean, thousands of people a year are now having an overdose reversed by naloxone that someone administers who may not be a member of the healthcare system.
I read in this USA Today piece, I read about the sort of the state of the chaos or the crisis in the state of addiction treatment in the U.S. And has the Affordable Care Act helped at all? And do insurance companies pay for treatment? And what is the state of treatment in the U.S. right now?
The Affordable Care Act helps a lot because it gives a lot of people who had no insurance insurance in the first place, and second, because it specifies insurance has to cover addiction. So all these new policies being issued to the state exchanges have it covered. That said, with the Affordable Care Act and then the mental health parity law, which was passed in 2008 and is supposed to give people more protection so that when they have an addiction someone in their family does, they can get the care. There's been a lot of pushback from the industry and not following the spirit of the law. Now, and a few state attorney generals have taken that on. The New York state attorney general has won some substantial settlements from a number of companies that denied care to people they deserved, and then people died. But there has not been a federal confrontation with the insurance industries about that, and I'm afraid there needs to be. The laws are in place, but, you know, they need to be followed.
You know, we talk about substance abuse, and I know you've talked about it in a moral sense, how important it is just morally as a nation to provide it. But substance abuse treatment really has a payback to the taxpayer,
right.
Doesn't
right.
it?
Right. Yeah. As always, we should do it because these are, you know, our fellow friends, citizens, our lovers, our parents. It's like any other illness. We should have that basic compassionate response. But if someone were looking at it with a colder eye than I do, not being in the field and saying, you know, what do I get out of it? The truth is, it's an incredibly good investment because, you know, when you treat people, you lower the likelihood that they will commit crime. You lower the likelihood that they will contract or transmit an infectious disease. It's more likely they're going to get a job. They're more likely to be a productive citizen. So when you don't pay for substance use treatment, you end up paying even more in all these other costs. So we really ought to do this, you know, even from the most, like I say, the most cold, rational point of view, we should be investing in substance use treatment.
How would you describe the heroin crisis today? How significant is it? How large is it? How much are these states in crisis? And what do they really need?
Yeah, so there's probably, you know, with our limited data systems, we don't know exactly how many people there are. There's probably about 1 million daily users of heroin, and then probably four times that many people who are heavily using illegal prescription opioids. You know, the states are experiencing high rates of death. I mean, soaring rates of death, including for a lot of young people. You know, it's very, you know, high, even more traumatic than it would otherwise be. You see people snuffed out right when their lives are really beginning. Some states have taken it on. Vermont, you know, for example, has been really, proactive. But I can tell you,
how have they been proactive?
Well, the governor gave a state of the state address where the entire thing was about substance use, and, you know, expanded methadone maintenance, which is a very good treatment. Buprenorphine maintenance. And Vermont has been pretty forward-thinking about health coverage in general. I mean, they really have worked pretty hard to try to get more people into healthcare in general, but also in addiction treatment.
But I think of Vermont as Ben and Jerry's. You know, it just doesn't have the thing that's interesting and surprising and shocking about this heroin epidemic is that it is New England, it is Vermont, it is New Hampshire, it is Maine.
Right. Yeah, and you know, it's not where people stereotypically think of drug problems. I think a lot of Americans, probably particularly a lot of white middle class Americans, they think heroin use means
urban,
inner city young black, you know, males or something, and that's not who this is at all. But you know, just to go back to the contrast between states. So I'm a West Virginian. I work very closely with my legislature, you know, they've passed some good laws and they've had some real leadership, but you know, it's a low income state. And, you know, it cannot do what Vermont can do, a relatively wealthy state, or Connecticut can do, or New Hampshire can do. And you know, when these epidemics hit in places that are already financially pretty challenged, they have lots of goodwill, they try really hard, but they just don't have the resources. And that brings you back to this, you know, federal question of where is the federal government? You know, where is Congress on this? Where, you know, there's a few champions, you know, there's who've been great, but broadly speaking, they must be hearing this from their constituents. And I wonder when they're going to respond at the level we need.
In places like West Virginia that you know very well, I would assume that the more that the close down of coal mines, that the evaporation of jobs from the coal industry,
right.
You know, the more that they get hit by higher unemployment numbers, the more desperate they're going to become.
Yeah, absolutely. And both in terms of being willing to deal substances, which some people may, you know, morally object to, but they just get pushed to a desperate place, and to the point when, you know, there's not a lot of else reward in life. And these are really potent chemicals. I mean, among the drugs, you know, opioids are very sticky. I mean, it's easy to get addicted to them, far easier than it is to get addicted to alcohol or cocaine, I would say. And, you know, so you put vulnerable people up against a pretty potent drug, and a lot of them are going to come out on, you know, on the wrong end of addiction.
What are some of the stories you hear when you go back to West Virginia about the impact of opioids upon people's lives?
You know, one thing I've heard over and over, I was talking to a friend of mine who's in the House of Delegates, and he said, you know, he'd gone to two funerals that month, and he said, of teenagers, and he said, from good families. And it's just that shock of, like, this is happening everywhere. This is not happening far off. It's not, when you read the cases, you know, if you see them in the newspaper, you know, it'll be like honors students. And they'll say, you know, this was a wonderful girl. This was a wonderful boy, you know, with two parents who loved them, you know. And you sort of say, like, you know, as a, you know, I'm a parent, you know, so you really feel like, gosh, they did everything I could do. And now they're burying their child. And so that you see that, and that's very terrifying. And then you do also see just the loss of hope, how that ends up, you know, leading people into drug abuse. You know, in the southern part, you know, the coal industry has dropped in value by, you know, more than 50% in the last couple of years. That's the biggest industry, you know, my home state has. So you have whole towns where very few people are working and are very, very poor, and they're just very discouraging places to live. And that's a very fertile environment for addiction to take hold.
So the teenagers that you're talking about, they're going in their parents' cabinets. They're getting opioids out, prescription drugs, legally given to their parents, grandparents, whomever. They're starting on these drugs. They're getting addicted to these drugs. These drugs run out. Then they're going to heroin. Is that the process?
That's exactly the process. One of the things, because we've been writing so many prescriptions for so long, most people have some in their home. And when I talk about this, I've asked people in the audience, I remember a colleague of mine, she said, I don't have any opioids. Well, that's not true. I guess I have there's like 29 Vicodin for when I twisted my ankle. Oh, and my husband had a surgery. We've got, you know, we've got some OxyContin. And she realized she had like, you know, 100 pills. Mm-hmm. And she actually just had a child. And I said, like, why don't you get rid of all that stuff, you know, before they go in. And that's the supply phase. You know, when we do surveys of people who use prescription opioids, where do you get them? That's the most common thing they say. I get them from my friends and my family, or I get them out of people's medicine cabinet. But that does eventually run out. You know, you take all the ones in the cabinet, or you sell them and all that. And then you are stuck. And so you go to the black market, and where you might get heroin, or and you know, and then die from it.
So what's it going to take to really confront this crisis?
Well, you know, I think there needs to be a national spokesperson on it, and I'm hoping it's going to be one of the people running for president. I saw, you know, Hillary Clinton was up in New Hampshire and said she was hearing about the opioid epidemic and was kind of shocked. And I was at one level shocked she was shocked, but of course I guess I work in this field. But, you know, she said she was going to make it a focus. I hope she does. I hope multiple other candidates do. Someone who can grab the national stage.
What about the Surgeon General?
Needs to talk about that. Well, I'm working with the Surgeon General now, actually, on who is interested in doing stuff on alcohol and drugs, and I think can be effective, and I think he's a good guy. At the same time, you know from being in Washington, Surgeon General doesn't actually sit in that powerful part of government, even though we respect the Surgeon General. Surgeon General reports to an assistant secretary. So I think it needs to be, he could be a part of it, but I think also we need someone higher up. And, you know, to me, I would like to see everyone who's running for president be asked in these debates, you know, we're going to lose probably 45,000 people this year to various types of overdose. What are you going to do about that? That's more people than die of suicide. That's more people who die of car accidents. That's more people who die of AIDS at its peak. You want to run this country? What are you going to do? And, you know, if several of them could take it on, I think that's the kind of galvanizing thing that could move it forward.
Keith Humphrey, thank you for joining me on One to One.
Always enjoy talking to you, Paul. Thank you.
The preceding program is copyrighted by the Board of Trustees of Stanford University. One to One is produced by the School of Medicine's Office of Communication and Public Affairs. For more information, please visit us at mednews.stanford.edu.